Okay, good afternoon. I'm Abby Williams, Vice President of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this event on the 2009 new DPRK revolutionary upsurge, a blast from the past or a new path. The Institute's Korea Working Group is pleased to be co-hosting this meeting with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, especially their North Korea International Documentation Project. I think this event is another example of USIP's fruitful collaboration with the Wilson Center and the Korea Working Group, which is chaired here at the Institute by Ambassador Solomon, the president of the Institute and directed by John Park, is the centerpiece of the Institute's efforts in addressing strategic challenges related to the Korean Peninsula. I think the New Year's joint editorial calling people to a new revolutionary upsurge was published in the Party, the Army, and the Youth papers at the start of the year. And outside observers pay close attention to such an editorial for two reasons. First, it is widely seen as laying out the government's policy priorities for the year. And second, it may hold insights into the closed country's overall policy direction. This editorial is similar to our U.S. State of the Union address. However, while the State of the Union address is usually followed by a televised response or rebuttal by a member of the opposition party, this is not an option in North Korea. The 2009 New Year editorial also specifically outlines plans for a new revolutionary upsurge to build a great, prosperous, and powerful nation. And it draws a direct parallel to Kim Il-sung's Cholima movement of the 1950s. And Kim Jong-il is reported to have launched his new upsurge in the birthplace of the Cholima movement on 24th of December 2008. It is not unusual for leaders of at times of great difficulty to recall great periods in their country's history for inspiration. But inspiration is one thing, and capability is quite another. The North Korean economy is smaller now than it was 20 years ago. North Korea relies on food handouts from international aid agencies. So a key question is, does North Korea have the resources and capacity to rebuild its weak economy and improve the quality of life for its 23 million people? So today we have assembled here an outstanding group of experts to examine the 2009 revolutionary upsurge, and we're going to use a historical lens as well as looking at contemporary challenges. As Churchill once observed, in history lies all the secrets of statecraft. So before I sort of introduce them in the order in which they will speak, let me ask Robert Litvak, who is also through the Wilson Center, to make a few brief opening remarks.
Oh, thank you. Just wanted to express how grateful the Wilson Center is to collaborate with U.S. Institute of Peace on this project. The North Korea International Documentation Project is a relatively new initiative of the center, established in 2006. But it's part of a broader effort that the center has mounted for over 20 years to tap into archives from the former socialist bloc to shed light not only on that history, but also to use history as a tool of policy analysis to inform decision-making as our officials proceed on the challenges that we face in dealing with North Korea. This project is under the direction of James Persson. It has the centerpiece of it is 60,000 documents from the former East Bloc archives. North Korea is notoriously known as the most opaque society in the intelligence world, the hardest target. The NKIDP has 60,000 documents from the Russian, Chinese, East European archives. They've been compiled on this particular case in this documentary reader. These are documents that the officials involved in the talks never thought they would see the light of day. So there's extreme candor in the discussions. You'll be addressing today a particular episode, the five-year plan, and looking at some of the resonance between that crisis and the current crisis. But if you look at the NKIDP website, you'll find telegrams between Stalin and Kim Il-sung on the decision to invade South Korea, a remarkable set of a remarkable documentary collection, which many of you in this exhibition are probably familiar with. And to those who have not seen it, I commend it to your attention. But I simply wanted to express how appreciative we are of this collaboration with USIP for James Person's leadership from our side, John Park here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. It's a pleasure to see Ambassador Solomon again, and we're delighted to collaborate on this. I just simply wanted to bring that kind of institutional perspective at the start of this seminar, which I think should be most interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the session will move in four movements, if you will, this afternoon. The first movement would be by James Person and then Schaefer, who will give us some insights on the Cholima movement from archival material. And then the second movement session, if you will be by our own John Park here at USIP. And John will discuss the relevance of the Cholima movement to the 2009 new DPRK revolutionary upsurge, and will address the key question: can regime solidification in this manner be replicated? And then in the third movement for the afternoon, Charles Armstrong will be our discussant and will reflect on some of the themes, the issues which have been raised. And then we will then have another movement where we'll have a question and answer period. You've come here to be engaged participants, so we look forward to your questions. So let me now give the floor to James Person and Ben Shaker.
Thank you very much, Dr. Williams. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. 2012 looms large on North Korea's horizon. Now, this has less to do with ancient Mayan prophecies of apocalyptic events than it does with the fact that 2012 is the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth. The great leader was born on April 15, 1912, coincidentally the day the Titanic sank. To celebrate this to mark this momentous occasion, and I'm talking about the birth of Kim Il-sung here, the leadership has declared that by 2012, the DPRK will become a strong and prosperous country, matching what they already tout as their achievements in politics, ideology, and military power. Now, to achieve this goal of becoming a strong and prosperous country, the North has chosen to revive an economic mobilization campaign originally launched over half a century ago, the Cholima Movement. This was recently announced in the New Year's joint editorial, which set policy goals for 2009. Not a good image of it. Now, the primary goal of the Cholima Movement, when it was launched in 1956, was to combine the programs of cultural and technological revolution to succeed in socialist industrialization. Through moralistic fervor and ideological appeal, the movement aimed to essentially remold man himself, transforming him into a good communist who would sacrifice himself for the sake of the collective interest. So why revive this campaign when, judging from the current state of the North Korean economy, it did not produce any lasting results. While North Korea's industrial production did in fact show tremendous growth during the period of the Cholimon movement, although there were, to be sure, shortcomings, as my colleague Grant Schaefer will discuss shortly, by the 1970s, just a few decades after the campaign was launched, the expansion of the North Korean economy came to an end. There was one noticeable success, or one notable success, that we can attribute to the Cholimon movement, however, and that was Kim Il-sung's Cultural Revolution. The Cholimon movement succeeded in subordinating individual thoughts and actions to the needs of the collective. And Kim was successful at couching all this in a way that made people feel patriotic. By reviving the Cholimon movement now, Pyongyang seems to be attempting to reinforce this notion of harmonious participation for the greater good of society. This is especially the case because, like in the 1950s, as I'll discuss briefly here, North Korea is once again being left to its own devices. The Cholimon movement took its name from a mythical winged horse, which could travel 1,000 li, or approximately 400 kilometers, in one day. The horse is said to have been too swift even to mount it. Through a combination of moralistic fervor and ideological appeal, the campaign was designed to spur people on to work as hard as this legendary horse. People were urged to mount the Cholimon. And for several decades, the term Cholimon carried as much weight as the word Juche in the political vocabulary for its ability to mobilize the masses, to create this notion of harmonious participation for the greater good of society, and to encourage people to become more self-reliant. Now, the image of the Cholimon still carries cachet in North Korea and appears on everything from currency, to stamps, cigarette packs, propaganda posters from later eras, from the 1990s. There are tractors named after Cholimon. There's 2000 model, or some earlier models. And of course, we have the 46-meter Cholimon statue in downtown Pyongyang. Now, the origins of the Cholimon movement can be traced to December 1956, when North Korea launched its first five-year plan. This was done at a time of crisis for North Korea, both externally and internally. So what were the key challenges at the time? Let's first look at external challenges. Now, in 1956, North Korea had just completed its highly successful three-year plan to restore the national economy after the Korean War. Now, its success, of course, owed a great deal to the massive economic and technical assistance provided by the Soviet Union and other fraternal communist countries. And here is a breakdown of some of that. And you can see that it really was a collective effort from the communist bloc. North Korea, of course, does not always admit to the usefulness of this outside aid. When the North Korean leadership planned for an even more ambitious five-year plan designed to construct the foundations for socialism, they assumed that the communist bloc would continue to provide material and financial support at the same level as during the post-war period. This actually proved to be far from the truth. Although the aid was still considerable, it was far less than what was needed for the five-year plan. For example, during the three-year plan, North Korea received from the Soviet Union the equivalent of $365.5 million. This amount sharply decreased to $156 million during the five-year plan, however. Now, this drastic decline was due in part to Soviet disapproval of the excessive buildup of heavy industry in North Korea. Indeed, from 1953, when Kim Il-sung first launched his post-war development strategy, the post-Stalin Soviet leadership criticized Kim's autarkic economic model, which was modeled after Joseph Stalin's own. They also disapproved of Kim Il-sung's Stalin-inspired cult of personality, especially in the wake of the 20th Party Congress of the CPSU, or the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, in February 1956. Now, internally, as the documents in our document reader discussed, there was opposition to Kim Il-sung's development strategy. His critics encouraged the great leader to focus more and more on the development of consumer goods and light industry. They also encouraged him to limit the emerging cult of personality. Now, although this group, which later became as the August factional group, was purged from the Korean Workers' Party in August 1956, the activities of this group and the effect on party unity and discipline continued to dominate political discourse inside the Korean Workers' Party for for the next 2 years. In fact, we can find references to the August group in documents as late as the mid-1960s, in conversations between Kim Il-sung and Albanian officials. Now, complicating matters with this group was the fact that they appeared to have outside support. In the wake of the August incident, a joint Sino-Soviet mission was dispatched to Pyongyang to take Kim Il-sung down a few pegs. This incident was forever tainted Kim Il-sung's relations with the Soviet Union and China. So the five-year plan and the Cholima movement were launched, therefore, at a time of crisis, both internally and externally. So how did Kim Il-sung go about meeting these challenges? With a drastically reduced funding base and refusing interference from anyone, Kim Il-sung launched a massive program to mobilize domestic resources to pay for the original five-year plan instead of actually revising it. Juche, at least the notion of economic self-reliance or self-sufficiency, evolved out of these internal and external crises. In fact, Cholima may be considered one of the first practical applications of Juche. Under these conditions, in December 1956, members of the Korean Workers' Party were sent to major factories throughout the country to explain the difficult situation to workers. Kim Il-sung himself visited the Kangsan Steel Factory, where he discussed with steel workers ways to bring about a new upsurge in production. As he explained, people in some country try to impose their factionalism upon us. People in another country try to get control of us in cooperation with those people. The factionalists in our country depend on their masters for support. He was speaking, of course, of the Soviet Union and China, especially in the wake of the Sino-Soviet intervention in September 56. Now, Kim Il-sung then went on to explain that Syngman Rhee in South Korea, with the support of the United States, was attempting to attack the North with the help. And then Kim then went on to ask the workers, whom shall we trust? There is none other than you that we can trust. He explained that it was only the hard work of laborers and the resulting increase in production that could help him in solving the country's problems and could help him overcome the challenges of the so-called factionalists. So it was a time of high excitement as North Koreans were swept away by an almost mystical belief that the stage of true communism was at hand, and people did in fact respond to his pleas. Now, when Kim Il-sung saw the overwhelming response of the workers to these personal pleas, the party officially launched the Cholima movement in June of 1958. And this was launched to organize and lead the revolutionary spirit of the masses to the highest possible levels in order to fulfill the five-year plan, and also to accelerate the construction of socialism in North Korea. Now, Kim Il-sung reportedly exclaimed that all the people are racing towards socialism on Cholima in response to the party's call. Now, the revolutionary spirit and labor enthusiasm of the working people are running very high in towns and villages, factories and mines, fisheries and stock farms. Now, the Cholima movement had a major impact on the economic situation, at least in the short term, and on the structure of the company. Let's first look at industrial production. Now, overall industrial production grew by some 44% during the five-year plan. The government continued to give priority to the growth of heavy industry, though it also rapidly developed light industry and agriculture at the same time. Now, because of this development strategy of balanced growth, local industry actually came to play an increasingly important role in industrial production. Local industries could first more efficiently utilize local labor and resources to satisfy requirements, and second, because of the developments of local industries were based on local resources and local labor, transportation and distribution costs were cut, and the government could therefore channel larger portions of its investment to the development of heavy industry. Now, in the collectivization of agriculture, North Korea did not make the same mistake as the Chinese in creating massive communes with some 5,000 households. The North Koreans did carry out a total collectivization of agriculture from some 16,000 agricultural cooperatives into 3,843 production units at the village or li level. So the Cholima movement utilized local resources to build local consumer goods industries and to stimulate the entire industrialization and collectivization of agriculture to develop a rural area and also to produce raw materials for industrialization. Now, as Kim Il-sung discussed with Zhou Enlai in the 1958 conversation included in the document reader, North Korea also decentralized authority over local industry and agriculture during this period. Levels of authority were eliminated until only four remained. You had the central authority, the province, or Do, the county, or Kun, and finally you had the village, Li. Authority over local industry was transferred from provinces to the counties to encourage them to be more self-sufficient and to use local resources, thus freeing up additional resources that could be channeled to heavy industry. Now, in 1959, the Cholima work teams were created. This was a system of socialist competition waged among teams of workers upholding a communist lifestyle and working under the lofty socialist ideal of one for all and all for one. A work team received the title of Cholima work team by setting production targets high enough to stand out among other work teams and by actually attaining the target. Now, while the honor of getting the title Cholima work team was not like getting a fistful of cash, it was still an honor in North Korea, and to this day, North Korea has looked to the mobilization techniques represented by the Cholima movement in general and by the Cholima work team movement in particular as a primary source of work incentive for promoting economic growth. Now, since the Cholima movement relied so much on people's initiative and effort, a new form of management was also devised, both for agriculture and for industry, during the first five-year plan of the Cholima movement. In February 1960, Kim Il-sung visited the Cheongsan-li collective farm, which is located just outside of Pyongyang. He spent some 15 days there, giving on-the-spot guidance on ways to correct deficient methods in agrarian management. After visiting the collective an additional 38 times over the course of 8 months, Kim introduced the Cheongsan-li method, which emphasized the systemic relationship between higher and lower organs with emphasis on political work and mass involvement. Basically, superiors were to witness firsthand the conditions on the ground and to work out practical solutions to problems. Material incentives were also important, an important component of the Cheongsan-li method. Goods produced in excess of the assigned quota were to be shared among members of work teams. Now, in industry, Kim Il-sung introduced the Taon system, which departed from the one-man management system that was inherited from the Soviet Union, and adopted as the highest managerial authority, a party committee of some 25 to 35 members elected from the ranks of factories. You have managers, you have workers, engineers, etc. With the shift from the Soviet model to a more self-reliant development strategy based on the mass line, worker participation and management was perceived as essential. And the Cholim Ang movement is often described as North Korea's great leap forward, and is often compared to the Soviet Stakhanovite movement. There were, to be sure, some similarities between the Great Leap Forward and Cholim Ang. They were certainly mutual influences due to the geographic proximity of China and North Korea. Now, both North Korea and China refused to mechanically import Soviet development strategies. They sought instead to apply the lessons learned from earlier stages of development. Also, both North Korea and China also focused on arousing people's energy and local initiatives. There are notable differences, however. The Great Leap Forward was launched after the Cholim Ang movement, which, as I said, had its origins in December 1956. Moreover, the Great Leap Forward, which was launched in May 1958, was closely associated with the creation of people's communes, these massive people's communes, which had 500 households, or 5,000 households. While the collectivization of agriculture was part of Cholim Ang, the Cholim Ang movement was most pronounced in the industrial sector. Moreover, while China's decentralization led to the virtual collapse of the planning system, North Korea actually introduced management systems during this period, the Chungsang Lee method and the Taon system. And it was only in the 1990s that these systems collapsed. Now, an often proclaimed objective of socialist policymakers was to catch up with and even surpass more developed capitalist countries. To achieve the rapid economic development necessary to actually achieve this, most socialist countries employed mass mobilization techniques in one form or another. The Cholim Ang movement could be interpreted as a similar initiative, such as the Stakhanovite movement in the Soviet Union, launched in 1935. Again, there are notable differences, though. The primary objective of the Stakhanovite movement was to increase production levels by cutting costs and completing economic plans. The Cholim Ang movement not only aimed at increasing production, it also aimed at transforming man himself. As I noted, transforming him into a good communist who would sacrifice himself for the greater, or for the sake of collective interest. Harmonious participation in Cholim Ang work teams for the greater good of society. The Stakhanovite movement, on the other hand, emphasized individual performance. Now, North Korea has repeatedly astounded the world with its ability to endure. There have been, as we all know, countless numbers of predictions of North Korea's imminent collapse. There's also a curious absence of popular protest in North Korea. And we might simply attribute this to an Orwellian totalitarian system. But I think Kim Il-sung did in fact succeed in creating a system where people were molded ideologically as communists and mobilized to constructive action. Moreover, they were told to make do with very little. And all of this was couched in a way that made people actually feel patriotic. This, I believe, is one of the most lasting contributions of the Cholim Ang movement. There exists in North Korea a group orientation that we are just not used to. There is this notion of harmonious participation for the greater good of society. It's not just about what's in it for me. And you can see this in the mass games of today, and in political rallies. Organization, discipline, and collectivism are key elements of the mass games. The mentality of collective effort runs throughout North Korean society, whether in construction or in mass games. This helps explain, I think, at least in part, why North Korea has not yet collapsed. Thank you.
I'm just going to make some brief remarks serving as a bridge between the first movement and the second movement of this afternoon. And I'm going to talk about basically the shortcomings and the problems which North Korea faced after the Solima movement. James has already referred to our document reader, which we have out there, and I recommend everybody to take a copy. In this document reader, you have a Polish document from 1958 making a statement on the five-year plan that the fundamental task of this plan is to resolve, at least in principle, the problems of food, clothing, and housing, which basically indeed was the purpose of the plan. The plan was a five-year plan, but I wrote 57, 59, 61 because there were some problems after the first 2 years, so 59 counted as a sort of transition year, so it wasn't a full-fledged five-year plan. Well, after the end of this plan in 61, you can see from the documents, and they just put together some highlights, some bullet points here, what the problems, how foreign observers who closely analyzed North Korean economy, and at that time had really some remarkable insights into how the North Korean economy worked, how they assessed the problems of the North Korean economy. The main problem certainly was agriculture, where you basically had a full range of shortcomings. The production was too low, the work productivity was too low, the food supply for the peasants was insufficient. There was quite some deficits with local industry in terms of producing consumer goods for the population in the countryside and people on the farms. There weren't enough farm machines, or they weren't working. There wasn't enough fertilizer. There was almost a constant decline in animal breeding. There were basically no incentives to produce and sell. The next major problem next to agriculture for North Korea, defined by those foreign observers, was insufficient energy production and supply for industry and consumers. And they were predicting in 1961 the problem is going to get worse, because North Korea is going to develop heavy industry at the expense of light industry. Heavy industry needs a lot of energy, and North Korea will fall even further behind in producing enough energy for industry. And this also led to major disproportion of industrial production and foodstuff production. There are also numerous accounts in those documents by foreign observers about the working habits and leadership style. Some of them you might even qualify as racist. But they have certainly at least some point with regard to leadership style, and as James has already explained, I don't want to go into further detail. It's no coincidence at all that those two basically pillars of North Korean economy way into the 90s, the so-called Cheongsan Ri method and the Taeyeon work system or work principle, were introduced in 60 and 61, because this was a period when those problems came up. And Kim Il-sung really made at least some innovations that he tried to, by himself, to solve the major problems of North Korean leadership style and work habits with the on-the-spot guidance, discussion of grievances and problem solving. Actually a very intimidating exercise. I mean, each factory with it by the leader was a very intimidating exercise to the people involved, certainly. Because it was completely unpredictable how he's going to spread blame and reward. But you could also couch it as a sort of management reform and at least an attempt to balance the party leadership versus the expert knowledge. Now I just want to jump, and this will be basically the bridge between what we will do in the first part of this afternoon and the second part. I just want to jump ahead by about 25 years. This is something we actually have to publish at some point. I think we haven't done it yet. It's a quite remarkable conversation between Kim Il-sung and the then East German leader Erich Honecker and Jiang Yang when he visited North Korea in October 1986. Because by then, there was a pretty close relationship between those two leaders. So Kim Il-sung really felt personally also very close, very trusting towards Honecker. And he made very open and frank remarks, which of course he expected never to become public in any way, and if those kind of remarks would have become public, or at least part of it in North Korea, this would have caused major trouble, of course. When he started with the remark, this is just for basically for the sake of irony, what I have here, people are sad that such deserving revolutionaries like the two of us also grow older. We don't have to worry, however, since we have done everything to ensure that future generations will continue our struggle. And basically, Kim's legacy will really indeed ensure that generations upon generations will have to continue the struggle, not basically have to struggle. Now, this is the quote from the leader himself in 1986, after 25 years after this first five-year plan. "We are a developing country confronted with three basic problems: supplying the population with food, solving the housing question, and the clothing question." Of course, implying those problems are not solved yet. He says, "We are confronted with some problems we cannot solve by our own means, like, for example, animal breeding and sugar production," which is a major statement by the creator of Chuchu. "I think we will be ultimately able," and then he developed some grand schemes how everything could be resolved within just short-term period by introducing certain measures, and I just want to share this with you because it's pretty interesting if it comes from Kim Il-sung himself. "I think we will be ultimately able to solve the food problem only if we expand or cultivate farmland to 5 million acres. And for 1986, he defined the amount of farmland in North Korea was 3.7 million acres. So 1.3 million acres had to be added. That's why we decided to win 740,000 acres of reclaimed land. Yet this is not easy. We have to claim it from the ocean. Furthermore, we are planning to create 495,000 acres of additional farmland for agricultural production in other parts of the country. Or in other words, if this doesn't work, North Korea is not able to feed its population, feed its people." The Namfo Sea Barrage was filled at that time by about 300,000 soldiers. It's also interesting that in this document, Kim Il-sung, there's now the military situation. It's a little bit more relaxed on the Korean Peninsula, but for the first time, we could afford to send the army in at this massive numbers. We couldn't do this before. So 300,000 soldiers were building this barrage for desalination, irrigation, and fertilizer. And then he said, "If we can use the reclaimed land completely for grain production, then we will have solved the food problem, and then we will be able to provide the population with necessary food products. In other words, if we don't succeed," which they didn't, "they can't." With regard to the clothing question, he said, "As far as the clothing question is concerned, then we have the problem that we have no cotton. Thus, we must primarily produce chemical fibers. During the 1960s, we already built a vinalon fiber plant with an annual capacity of 50,000 tons. This is also the so-called Chuche fiber, because this fiber was developed by a North Korean chemist in 1939, and this person moved to North Korea in 1950, and then he stayed in North Korea. So this huge plant was actually built in the city which East Germany completely rebuilt after the Korean War, Hamhung. It was only 1961. That of course, there's a gap between 1961 and now 1986. Now, in 1986, he's saying, "Currently, we are building a new plant in Suncheon with an annual production of 100,000 tons of chemical fibers. In addition, we produce 15,000 tons of viscose fibers on the basis of timber, and also, I don't know about those other fibers I have to admit, and also anilon and movilon fibers. Altogether, we will be able to produce 200,000 tons of synthetic fibers annually. On this basis, we could fundamentally solve the clothing question for our country," which, despite this huge 1961 factory, Vinalon factory plant, has not been solved for the 25 years thereafter, and now there are new plans to solve it. And with regard to housing, this also goes in a lot of details. He basically announced that we want to build annually between 150,000 and 200,000 housing units. We need a lot of housing space, also implying that by 1986, this problem had not been solved. There was insufficient housing. And then he basically said to the Erich Honecker at the end of this talk in October 86, "With our third 7-year plan, we want to finally solve this final results, the three main tasks. This is the foundation for all our efforts. We have to accomplish this first. This is, again, 1986. And of course, he's not talking about all the different priorities which North Korea had set between 61 and 1986, which contributed to the situation, because they did not look first in many respects with to sort of the agricultural problems, but the militarization of the country and all these different aspects of how to build a very strong defense or offensive capacity, whatever was in discussion in the 60s and 70s within the North Korean leadership. This, of course, took a lot away from the civil economy, and another, of course, maybe major distraction to developing the economy and to feeding the people was a project like building Pyongyang into the showcase of the North Korean socialism. And just the Pyongyang project, which is an ongoing project, took a lot of resources away from other parts of the country. And I will close my remarks with something from January 2009. I think it's even after this editorial we just talked about, this 2009 editorial for the New Cholima Movement. This is from the North Korean Central Broadcasting System, and there's a quote: "Nothing is more important to improving the lifestyles of the people than the food problem. The food problem must be resolved first. There is no more urgent or important task than solving the eating problem." And that's where we are today, in 2009. And we will discuss this later, how Korea will manage, North Korea will manage in 2012 to become the prosperous country it promises to be. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, James and Brian. We had two very insightful, interesting presentations to get us started. I'm looking at the clock, and it seems that we are 10 minutes ahead of schedule, which is a good place to be at these kind of events, because the second movement of the afternoon performance was to start at 3 o'clock. So I want to take the liberty of being the chair to see if there are any burning questions from the audience at this stage. We could take those, and then before moving on to John Park's presentation. Yeah, if you just give your name and affiliation, that would be helpful.
The gentleman from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. A really trivial question: what's the difference between the food problem and the eating problem? So can you explain that a little bit?
Well, these are not my phrases. Well, the food problem, I would basically define as the supply in all kinds of respects, and, well, of course it is related to eating, so it's a different phrase, but this is an English translation of Korean terms, and maybe they even were sort of identical in Korean. I really don't know about the exact terms, but I don't think this is a major issue.
No, just curious, if it's a dietary issue, if there's a program along, with the food issue to eat certain things and so on.
I think it's basically about whether having enough to eat. I mean, that's okay. The problem. What we eat.
I'm with the Georgetown University. That's a visiting scholar. My name is Yong Ki-yo. And glancing at this huge thick book, Mr. Bernard Schaefer, the article there, and on page 33, caught my eyes that the China's cultural revolution, which now instigated in 1966, represents a serious threat to Kim Il-sung's autocracy.
Yes.
Now, I have to agree with you on that, but my question is to Mr. James Parsons, because you talked about Cholima movement, and China also had a great reform movement simultaneously before North Korea. My question is, did Kim Il-sung learn from China or vice versa?
Thanks. I addressed that a bit in my presentation. In fact, Cholima was launched before. the origins of Cholima can be traced back to December of 1956, whereas the Great Leap Forward was launched in May of 58. But there were, to be sure, some similarities. As I said, they both relied on ideology and on mobilization of the masses. And they were both, in both Mao and Kim Il-sung, resisted importing mechanically development strategies from the Soviet Union, as the Soviets were encouraging them to. This was, remember, a time when the new course was being promoted throughout the communist bloc. And there were, to be sure, individuals within the Korean Workers' Party and individuals perhaps in China. Peng Do-hye was later purged for supporting a more new course style reform, economic reform. There were individuals inside the parties who wanted to adopt this, but Kim Il-sung and Mao resisted this. There were differences, though. There were fundamental differences. As I mentioned, the Great Leap Forward focused primarily on the communes, whereas the Cholima movement was focused primarily on industry. Though it was also, I mean, it also did. There were also initiatives in agriculture.
May I just add one thing? I've published a working paper on China-North Korean relations between 66 and 72, and I can get it to you, and that you get all the details why the Cultural Revolution was indeed a major threat to Kim Il-sung's rule. Mm-hmm.
There were some copies out front.
Okay. Okay. I didn't know that. Okay.
Hi, Amanda Wood with the National Endowment for Democracy. I was just curious, you mentioned earlier that Cholima for a period of time was kind of the key word that they used. Is that something that now, with an official language, the current conversation, or even in colloquial conversation, is Cholima kind of a taboo thing for them to discuss directly because it was so obviously, you mentioned, a failure?
Oh, no.
Or do they still, I guess I might be jumping the gun for the next movement, but what's the current status of using Cholima movement and its
Now, Cholima is still very much, the movement, unlike the Great Leap Forward, the Cholima movement never actually ended because the North Koreans avoided a lot of the disastrous results of collectivization, for example, that the Chinese encountered when building the communes. No, but Cholima, in fact, as I showed, there was a poster from the 1990s which was evoking the image of the winged horse, or the Cholima. You still have this 46 meter statue in the center of Pyongyang, of the Cholima horse. The image is all over the place, actually. It's and they're reviving the Cholima movement again today to achieve the goals of becoming a strong and prosperous country by 2012. It's certainly not taboo. It's considered, I think, one of the more successful movements in their past.
I guess a follow-up for it would be John. Later on, maybe you'll answer the question during your presentation, but do you think people are up for that? Do they have the power and the strength to be able to continue or to revive or renew
John, I'm sure you've taken good
sure.
note of that question.
Yes.
You might wish to address it in your presentation. Any more questions? Fine.
Well, I'll ask just another one. You mentioned three things, the animal breeding and the sugar and the desalination of reclaimed land. We've been trying to do some peaceful scientific engagement with North Korea. And although we've been unsuccessful in really doing anything and getting anything going, each one of those subjects, sugar beet, animal breeding, particularly of goats, and reclamation or desalination of reclaimed land have all come up in the discussion. Have those problems, to your knowledge of the present state, been at all solved?
guess not.
I don't think so, either.
I don't think so. But I don't have hard data on the current situation on those issues.
What's interesting is, I don't know if you saw in the conversation between Joe and Lai and Kim Il-sung in 58, they are talking about sugar. And they're asking, should we produce, Kim Il-sung asks Joe and Lai, should we produce sugar cane? Or should we grow sugar cane, or should we grow sugar beets? And Joe says, clearly sugar beets, that's the best way to go forward. Didn't learn from the lesson though, I guess.
I have one question, which is a prerogative of the chair, maybe I should pose. You mentioned that one of the lasting legacies, and certainly one of the successes and lasting legacies of the Cholima movement was this underlying of the importance of a collective effort and harmonious participation for the good of the society. And my question is, were there certain elements, culturally or otherwise, historical or otherwise, in North Korea, which helps explain why this was successful? And could this be something which could have been replicated in any other place?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And when thinking about this, something came to mind, actually. The second miracle on the Han movement in South Korea. I was thinking of people collecting gold and donating their gold to be melted down and to create resources for the South Korean government. And I wondered if there was some deeper Korean dynamic to it that transcends political systems. But that's a good question, but I'm afraid.
Well, if we don't have any other questions at this stage, why don't I give the floor to John Park, who will move us to the next movement, looking at the relevance of the Cholima movement to the 2009 New Revolutionary Observer. John.
Thank you, Abby. Thank you all for coming today as well. Let me move quickly to the contemporary phase. Now that we have a background with what happened with the development of Cholima, some of the interesting obstacles and some of the trends, I'll be dividing my talk into three phases, but before I do that, a quick disclaimer that these are my views and don't really reflect the Institute here. The first point that I'd like to focus on is this idea that really, it's a fundamental question. How will Kim Jong-il be able to pursue economic reconstruction, one of the main themes and focuses in the 2009 New Year's editorial? And in the course of doing that, solidify his regime. There is some aspect of a leadership transition occurring in North Korea. There have been reports saying that this is quite dramatic and something that will be quite important for the regime, and others saying that this will be more of an organic type of process. But within the broader context of, I think, the more immediate capabilities analysis of economic reconstruction, we can put some pieces together. The second part, I'll look at the Sino-UPRK relationship. As James mentioned, that one period where, during the period right after the Korean War, North Korea relied on the resources and the help of a lot of its communist country brethren, we're now in a phase where, especially in a very isolated situation for North Korea, the Sino-UPRK relationship is suddenly very important. Considerably important for a long period of time now, especially with the chairmanship of the six-party talks and some of the lower-level activity. But from the lens of the 2009 New Year's editorial, there's another specific salience to the bilateral Sino-DPRK relationship. And the third part, I'll look at the question, this idea that is the new revolutionary upsurge a blast from the past or a new path? I would argue that it is a blast from the past, and that in incorporating the Cholima type of ideas and goals and group mentality, Kim Jong-il is adding one new element, which is North Korea incorporated. And I'll go into a little more detail about what that means, a little more color of the North Korean state company system. To start off with, the current landscape in Northeast Asia for North Korea is one of isolation. That is a clear fact. And if you look at the DPRK, ROK relationship with the inauguration of the conservative Union Bloc administration in Seoul and the introduction of Vision 3000, this linkage between economic assistance and opening, this idea that in 10 years' time, the GDP in North Korea will be raised to $3,000 if North Korea makes movements towards denuclearization. After the introduction of Vision 3000, we see a spiraling in the inter-Korean relationship. If we look closely at Vision 3000, a foundational piece of this is a very simple equation, an assumption in the South Korean government's mind that economic priorities are more important than political priorities, and political priorities are more important than security priorities. And if you look at the incentives and what the South Korean government is offering by way of concessions and other aid for North Korea, it's very much based on this simple flow here. Some argue that this is inverted, that in fact, from the North Korean perspective, it's really about security priorities being much more important than political priorities, being much more important than economic priorities. That's not to say that economic priorities are not important, it's just that the sequencing of its relations and what they'll go after in terms of negotiations are predicated more on the security being greater than the political, being greater than the economic. If we look at the North Korean-U.S. relationship, there's a great deal of uncertainty right now. The administration is settling in, assigning people. People are getting posted to various positions, and we will slowly see the unveiling of a policy, but we have yet to see what that policy is. The primary question here is, in looking at the North Korean nuclear problem, will North Korea be classified as an urgent problem or an important problem? That has direct implications on another approach dealing with North Korea, which is, do you manage the North Korean nuclear crisis or do you seek to resolve the North Korean nuclear crisis? These are fundamental questions in that they feed into the linchpin of U.S. policy in Asia. How the United States decides to deal with North Korea will influence its policies with Japan, with South Korea, with China. So this is a very delicate situation right now, but as I mentioned before, it's a period of uncertainty because there is no U.S. policy at this particular point in time. Although we're in the first few days before Secretary Clinton goes to Asia. Even after her visit, there's unlikely to be a clear policy. So as this policy develops, as it's formulated, as it's implemented, there still will be that element of uncertainty. If we look at the North Korean-Japanese relationship, the centrality of the Uduak-Ddee issue has led to North Korea being more isolated, but also in a related fashion, Japan being marginalized in the six-party talks. This is a remarkable development in the sense that Japan, in insisting on the importance of the Uduak-Ddee issue to its national interests, are being basically told by the other members of the six-party talks that they are sympathetic to the Uduak-Ddee issue, but that the six-party talks is about denuclearization. And so the Uduak-Ddee issue is not linked in a formal sense, although it is the main focus of the six-party talks working group looking at Japan DPRK normalization. The question here is, in this larger environment of isolation, under what circumstances will North Korea revisit the Pyongyang Declaration? And that was a culmination of a period of very high-level negotiations between the Koizumi government and the North Korean government that was a very comprehensive approach to looking at a host of issues that would have led to normalization of relations between North Korea and Japan, and also North Korea receiving reparations. So this is a very comprehensive agreement that is still on the tables, but it clearly is frozen at this particular point in time. Now, if we fast forward to the North Korean-Chinese relationship, this bilateral relationship has developed into, for lack of a better term, something that has a two-pronged nature to it. At the very high level, the highest levels, China engages other countries in dealing with the six-party talks with denuclearization. And that's something that we've seen in a lot of reports, in a lot of studies. But with respect to the second component of that, the bottom-up, the lower-level interaction of China with North Korea, that is an area that is very much overlooked and under-examined. With respect to China's overall approach to dealing with North Korea through this two-pronged approach, China has the ability to hedge in certain instances and be flexible, but by no means is it something that is completely in China's control. If you talk to Chinese officials who deal with the North Korean nuclear issue at the high level and those who on the localized level deal with commercial interactions with North Korea, dealing with North Korea is very complicated. It is something where one of the very few issues where I think China is completely befuddled and There is attempt to try to manage the situation, do best they can, but there's so many mixed domestic, local, international interests that it is truly a feat in terms of juggling a lot of balls at one time. To bring a contemporary context to all of this, the global financial and economic crisis, which is affecting all of us, here the question is, China being politically willing to assist North Korea in its economic reconstruction and other efforts to focus on its economy is something that China has been counseling and advising North Korea for many years now. And it looks like there's an opportunity for China to have an impact in that area. So there's a political will in China. Now with the global financial and economic crisis, I think there's a fundamental capabilities question. What is the extent of China's capabilities economically to assist North Korea in this endeavor? Clearly, it's not a zero sum. China doesn't give any aid, is not able to help, but it's really about the quantity and the manner in which China will be able to economically engage North Korea as they go through some of these economic reconstruction efforts. I wanted to take a quick step back and put North Korea into perspective. These are statistics from 2002. We look at population, the countries here, US, China, the spike there, South Korea, Japan, North Korea. One of the themes in all of these little charts will be how North Korea barely shows up. So we look at GDP, North Korea barely shows up. Same thing with GDP per capita, same thing with military expenditure. Now, if we look at North Korea in terms of its percentage of GDP allocated to military spending, North Korea is clearly the leader here, hands down. Fundamental question here, and there are many implications from looking at the statistics, but one takeaway is, given this allocation of resources and something that has been pretty consistent, how will North Korea in 2009, having laid out the new revolutionary upsurge and ideas of focusing on economic reconstruction, be able to pursue those goals when 25% of its GDP is allocated to the military? That's a fundamental capabilities analysis. The numbers have to add up somehow. And when you look at this chart, it's hard to see how North Korea will be able to go along the path laid out in 2009 leading up to the year 2012. Making a comparative analysis here in terms of the Cholyama movement and the 2009 new revolutionary upsurge, as James mentioned in certain parts, the Cholyama movement in the 1950s, Kim Il-sung drew on the massive sympathy of the communist world after the Korean War. The aid that came to North Korea was profound. In terms of its scale and scope. There were community-based fundraisers in places in Eastern European countries where, aside from state assistance, your average citizen in these Eastern Bloc countries would raise money to send to North Korea. Some have invoked the comparison in the Arab world, the sympathy for what's going on in Gaza. The idea that in the Arab world, the desire to help and contribute to the reconstruction in Gaza is something that's really mobilizing. And in a similar fashion, the post-Korean War situation in North Korea was something that galvanized the communist world. At this particular point in time, Kim Il-sung, through his diplomacy and trips to the Eastern Bloc countries, was able to diversify his bilateral relationships. He built up essentially a portfolio of donors. And these are the people who, in countries, eventually contributed and was a key enabler of the economic reconstruction goals laid out in the first five-year plan that is at the core of the Cholyama movement. Now, if we look at the contemporary phase in the new revolutionary upsurge, in this, again, environment of profound isolation, North Korea is particularly dependent on North Korea for two things. One is commercial engagement, and I'll go into that in a little more detail later on in terms of the North Korea incorporated analysis. But the second is regime validation. This past fall was a very active time for North Korea watchers because of Kim Jong-il's health, the implications on regime, concerns that pretty much the leadership had, a collective leadership had emerged and that we hadn't seen it, but essentially it boils down to a wide spectrum of speculation. North Korea attempted to release photos showing that Kim Jong-il had inspected this, gone to see this game and whatnot to show that he was up and about and that his health was fine. But it was only after the head of the Chinese Communist Party's International Liaison Department, Wang Dae, went to visit Pyongyang, took photos, and these were photos that were taken by the Chinese state news agency, and showed a very thin Kim Jong-il, but a healthy Kim Jong-il. And rumors about his health and imminent crises and whatnot, at this particular point in time, have been lowered. So again, this idea of regime validation is an important component of what is happening in the new revolutionary upsurge. And in the Joint New Year's editorial, there's specific references to Kim Jong-il's health and how he is fine and fully in control. The second component of this new revolutionary upsurge is a revisiting of that fundamental quandary of China being politically willing and able to support North Korean economic reconstruction plans, but China already feeling the effects of the global financial and economic crisis. As the primacy of economic development goals in China continue to preoccupy the leadership, as certain crises points occur in North Korea, it'll be very interesting how China deals with North Korea. And now that's a very careful statement to make in the sense that it's not a binary yes or no, shutting off aid or keep the aid going, but a relative. It talks about the quantity, the flow, the manner in which that will continue. I think those things will have to be reevaluated. In terms of the third point here, if the, leaning or dependent relationship that China that North Korea has with China is something that will become deeper in a new revolutionary upsurge period, what would North Korea's plan be? I don't want to go into too much speculation here, but there are clear parameters laid out. The year 2012 and the economic goals set out that have to be achieved by 2012 are somewhat firm. Other goals in North Korean economic activities can be revised and whatnot. But 2012 is the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung. Now, how do you back out of a situation where you've set up this thriving economy in 2012 if you're not able to meet that? I think the only recourse is to revise Kim Il-sung's birthday, which I don't think the North Koreans will do. But clearly this idea of Plan B, I think we have to start thinking about that very carefully. I wanted to take the opportunity here to zero in specifically on China's bottom-up approach. As I mentioned before, China's leadership in six-party talks, the way it engages North Korea through its Communist Party to the North Korean Workers' Party angle, is something that we've heard a lot about, and it's been covered very, very closely. But the bottom-up angle is something that is quite complex, and there are two important functions that China is able to realize and implement through this bottom-up approach. The first is providing a coping mechanism to the North Korean market. If you look at the Yongbyon region, there is this bottom-up commercial interaction activity that's happening. And a lot of that is happening at the very localized level. You know, we hear about the large Chinese state-owned enterprises going in and developing North Korean mines, but there is also this lower-level commercial activity. And one way to describe it is that the commercial activity on the Chinese side, you have some...
Can you talk to the microphone? Can hardly hear you back here.
Sure, thank you. So you have a situation where I think in one respect you can characterize it as wholesale goods being purchased, on a wholesale basis on the Chinese side, brought to North Korea and sold on a retail basis. Now this type of commercial activity is important because there are many people involved on both sides. And what we see on the North Korean side is a monetization of relationships in order to facilitate more of this commercial, very localized level commercial activity. Now, this is by no means sufficient activity to enable the whole country to affect economic reform, but proximity matters. The counties and provinces on the North Korean side that are closer to this phenomenon have fared better than their countrymen in other parts of North Korea, particularly closer to the DMZ. Now, with this type of monetization of relationship and commercial activity, we've seen the increase in corruption. And corruption is something that, from our perspective, is perhaps a negative thing, a drain or somehow creating inefficiency, a sign of a crumbling of the regime. But going along the lines of a coping mechanism, this corruption is creating, in one respect, revenue for localized government agencies on the North Korean side. So in a system on a North Korean national basis that hasn't really recovered, we see the opportunity for different localized government agencies to draw on this corruption to fund operating budgets. So this type of flexibility, again, feeds into this coping mechanism approach and behavior, but also has implications in terms of how China would like to continue to engage North Korea at this localized level. The other dynamic in terms of the stabilizing function at the bottom-up level is China's focus on fueling its economic development in the sub-regional sense in the northeastern region of China. Here this ties into a very important Chinese national goal, which is social stability, and the effort to close the gap between the rich and poor in China as they continue with their economic development plans. From the perspective of how North Korea fits into all of this, developing and transporting energy resources on the North Korean side into China is a very critical element to these broader sustainable economic development plans in that particular region. Now, as we see this activity grow, there are important spillover effects on a beneficial basis to the new revolutionary upsurge activities for North Korea. But as I mentioned before, as North Korea and its activities with China are influenced by China's more or less difficulties in dealing with the financial and economic crisis, there will be an implication in this area as well. Now, when we view the broader Chinese economic engagement of North Korea during the new revolutionary upsurge, there's some perceived implications by different groups. This is an image from the Joseon Ilbo, which really is capturing a South Korean public sentiment that China is trying to make North Korea into the fourth Chinese province. Now, from that view, from a South Korean view, I would say, China's 50-year concessionary leases on mines in North Korea are suddenly creating concerns that the previous South Korean reunification plans were very much binary, incorporating North and South Korea, suddenly have to deal with long-term obstacles. You know, Chinese investment in North Korea is a reality. And while we've seen a lot of activity of Chinese investment and development of mines, in the Chonmo period, especially laying out the development of the steel industry, this perhaps is will be a focus of joint venture activities between the Chinese and the North Koreans. So keep your eye on the North Korean steel industry. This isn't a complete revival of the industry, but more activity in this area. And again, proximity matters. Because to do steel development, you need access to electricity, to resources, transportation lines. Proximity to the border and closer connection to Chinese entities that will help facilitate this development will be very, very important. Now, as this greater Chinese interaction with North Korea, this economic engagement continues, there's also this perceived notion that as this deepens, North Korea's reliance on the PRC will grow. And as a result, in almost a direct correlation, Chinese influence on Pyongyang, and especially Pyongyang's denuclearization activities, will grow. Here, I revisit that equation of economic priorities being greater than political priorities being greater than security priorities. Clearly, this view is based on that understanding. And I would offer the reminder that in a lot of North Korean activities and behavior, it's a complete inverse. So we really have to revisit what North Korea's priorities will be. Now, on the surface of that, it looks somewhat overlapped in the sense that if the Cholima movement being invoked in the 2009 New Year's editorial focuses on economic reconstruction and vitalization, then would this mean that this ratio is somehow a primary directive for the North Korean leadership? I would caution that the idea of economic priorities in this sense are very different from the Cholima type of economic reconstruction. Cholima economic reconstruction is tied very much with the leadership consolidation. So while the terminology may be similar, I think they have to be thought of as different. When we look at this idea of why the new revolutionary upsurge is laid out in the 2009 New Year's editorial is a blast from the past or a new path, as I mentioned earlier, my belief is that it is a blast from the past, but that North Korea has a new tool. And it is this idea of a North Korea incorporated. If you look at every branch of the North Korean state structure, they have a trading company or some sort of business entity. And that business entity has two functions. One is to generate funds, one to be sent to Kim Jong-il and the inner group, and the second is to provide operating budget for that particular entity. And a loose capturing of this phenomenon as North Korea Incorporated shows how the goals are the same here in terms of economic reconstruction and regime solidification. And the importance of Cholima, as James and Vernon mentioned, this idea of fostering a group mentality to shoulder these burdens as they work towards 2012 are very, very important. But this new tool of the approach to dealing with the commercial opportunities with China as the economic reconstruction goals are laid out and as activities are made in that direction. The North Korea Incorporated approach offers a lot of opportunity to engage Chinese at different levels. So it's a very practical engagement mechanism. Now, the caveat here is that North Korea Incorporated is not the answer to all of the concerns of North Korea. Some would argue that this North Korea Incorporated approach is something that evolved over time to adapt to realities of the situation. Others would say that the North Korea Incorporated system is really one large coping mechanism. But in the context of these new revolutionary upsurge goals, North Korea Incorporated really offers this opportunity to make advancements in terms of electricity generation, focus on heavy industry, on steel, and the overall idea of building the economic situation. As it relates to regime solidification, the North Korea Incorporated structure also offers an opportunity for a collective leadership, as there is some aspect of a leadership transition in North Korea. If you look at the collective leadership, in a post-Kim Jong-il period, each member of that collective leadership will have to have the ability to generate money on a regular basis. So their ability to rule, their ability to develop and maintain the overall system, I think is very much dependent on the idea of North Korea Incorporated being a means for the regime solidification itself. So it's a very multi-purpose approach to looking at this phenomenon that is North Korea Incorporated. Apologies that this diagram is not that clear, but this is something that we put together after defector interviews in Seoul. We conducted interviews with North Korean defectors who had worked in North Korean state companies. And the org chart that they drew is something that may seem very benign, but if you think of this type of org chart, and at each level there being a trading company or some sort of business enterprise, you can see how this North Korea Incorporated structure is something that, from the very lowest levels to the highest levels, there is a compensation function in the sense that with the demise of the national distribution system, the demise of the ability to have national budget to run state organizations, North Korea Incorporated in this structure adds a very important element of coping mechanism, but also gives a little more understanding of how things may be operating inside North Korea. It's clear that this isn't definitive in the sense that the numbers of defectors that we interviewed were small, but they were unique in terms of that background of having worked in North Korean state companies. Now, to give you just a quick summary here, based on the sketch laid out, you have the National Defense Commission, of which Kim Jong-il is chairman, and then you have the secret bureaus that really are funding directly to Kim Jong-il. Then, as you go down the org chart, you'll see the familiar Korea Workers' Party, below that the cabinet, and it branches out to the Korea People's Military and the National Defense Ministry. Under each of these levels, you have different units, but at a certain point below, there's something called foreign currency generating bases. These are essentially business operations that rely on local labor, conscripted labor as well, that is essentially brought into these operations to do things like cultivate mushrooms for export to Japan, deal in state commodities like gold. And as these are generated by a system where the top makes a very clear work authorization in terms of what the quota will be for that particular entity to go out and cultivate and eventually sell, you get to see how this overall mechanism that is North Korea Incorporated, you get to see how it functions. And you see through this, I think eventually through other iterations of research in this area, which areas are very active, which areas have high volume, which areas are growing. And I think you can make one hypothesis that as you start tracking that, that will denote which parts of the regime are influential, which parts of the regime are essentially the dominant within this overall structure. Caveat is that when it comes to something like the Korean People's Army and the terminology of military, we've heard a lot that in North Korea, the country is run by the military. Military is a very gross, oversimplified terminology in the sense that within the military, you have a section that's a field military, the political section, then you would have the NDC, the National Defense Commission. So this overall structure is something that you get to see more flavor of through their commercial activities. each group needs to generate money because there is no money coming from a centralized place sufficient for operating budget. So this type of activity is something that is growing, and the implications of this, on one side, people view this as an indicator that the North Korean state company will collapse under its own weight, that there are so many inconsistencies, that corruption, that the inability to control every section of this org chart shows a weakening of the power of the center. Then there is another interpretation that's saying that this is really flexible, that this is something where you essentially enable people to rely on their own incentive structure, that corruption isn't a bad thing, that it funds operating budget, and that it's creating opportunities but also a means to engage Chinese and others as they flesh out the goals for 2009. Caveat again is that North Korea Incorporated is not the answer to North Korea's problems, but it's a new growing development that I think provides new insights into the North Korean regime and the leadership structure. Let me conclude with three points. The first is that as we see the current situation of North Korea's isolation, in an immediate step, its ability to reach out to China and foster closer relations is within grasp. For North Korea to make those overtures to the United States or to South Korea, that will take some time. But there's also a concern that from the North Korean perspective, those are things that will not only take time, but can be quickly turned up, turned off or on based on political considerations, progress with denuclearization and so forth. With the urgency and the goal laid out of 2012, there isn't really much time. So something that is close and something that looks like a likely partner to achieve these development goals is China. China is reciprocating. This is the year of the 60th anniversary of the founding of bilateral relations between Beijing and Pyongyang. So within this broader context, there's a lot of opportunity to engage in the celebration of the relationship by building bridges, you know, the support for factories in key areas. So clearly there's a political packaging of this type of assistance for this year. The second point is that while we see the opportunity to go to the route of having closer relations with China, and China being very much willing to do this in a manner that is symbiotic, because China sees the development of key parts of North Korea as important for its own development goals in the border region, we are now confronted with the capability constraining problem that is the financial and economic crisis. That is something that China is already buckling in terms of very specific areas of foreign direct investment drawing up, of rising unemployment in key areas. These are things that are not particularly well reported on our side, but on the Chinese side, these are very strong concerns, and one would say a priority in terms of Chinese calculations of how to conduct certain policies at this particular point in time. The last point is this idea that the 2009 new revolutionary upsurge is indeed a blast from the past. And while we do see things that are very familiar, like the invocation of Cholima, and Cholima being important in terms of this broader package approach to achieving the goals laid out in the New Year's editorial, the new development, in a broader sense, I would call it localized commercial engagement, but in a specific sense, I would give it the term North Korea Incorporated, is a phenomenon that we really have to pay more attention to and examine in more detail. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, John. And well, we have perhaps we could take a few questions before we turn it over to Charles Armstrong to do questions and reactions to John's presentation. And perhaps I could pose the first one, because John, you argue that the goals for 2020 are really fixed, and that there could be a problem if they are not met, and you quit that they couldn't possibly, perhaps we'd have to change Kim Il-sung's birthday. But my question would be, so what if they're not met? If somebody were to say, are there any costs if the goals are not met? In other societies, we've just gone through in this society the therapy of elections every 4 years, where you could hold a leader accountable. And even sometimes, leaders in open societies do not meet their goals, so they explain them away and they get re-elected. So my question would be, so what if the goals are not met? Are there any costs for the regime? And will this affect regime stability in any way?
Based on the defector interviews, 2012 is important as a handing over period and something where a smooth handover succession is very well couched, very well structured. And so when it comes to stability and expectations, those would have to be managed. And so clearly it could be missed and there could be a delay. But 2012 is something where a lot of eggs have been put in that 2012 basket. The other parts of the analysis of 2012, to take a step back, 2012 is a very interesting year, not only from Hollywood's perspective. There's a blockbuster movie coming out called 2012, which basically talks about the Mayan prophecy of the end of the world. But 2012, in a very practical sense, there'll be a new administration in Washington. There'll be a new president in South Korea. There'll be leadership transfer in China, I should say. We will see OPCON transfer from the U.S. to South Korean forces in South Korea, and also this idea of succession and the thriving Kangsong-Daeguk realization in 2012. So there are many variables at play. So I would say that in the midst of that period of uncertainty, if you view it from this angle of the current administration in Washington still having not laid out a North Korea policy, it's in the works but it hasn't come out yet, can you imagine in 2012 when you have different governments all trying to figure out what their policy and approach will be to a host of issues, but specifically North Korea?
Thank you. So, any questions?
Chiao Chen, freelance correspondent. One of your key points is this, the isolation of North Korea withdrawal, the northern coast to China. My perception is this: if that there's a peace agreement and normalization among these three actors, U.S., North Korea, and South Korea, and then there's some engagement and connect among these three groups, then there's a trust building up. And will be this good for the everybody, and particularly good for the three actors?
I agree very much that that's an ideal outcome and something that. Oh, sure. Would you mind? Yeah, just maybe just to recap the question or the statement was that for the U.S., South Korea, and North Korea to work towards normalization of relations, being a way to have stability in the region.
One is peace agreement, and because
sure.
The war is not finished.
Right.
Yeah, that's a state of war.
Right.
Okay, your peace agreement and your normalization.
Right.
And if this is a good thing to do, is that feasible, and how to bring it up?
Sure. So the question was, in a two-stage approach for South Korea, North Korea and South Korea to first conclude a peace agreement and then move towards, I forgot the second part.
So include U.S. too?
Yes.
I'm saying three.
Right, the three parties. So move from peace agreement to the second part. What was the second part you mentioned?
Normalization.
Normalization of relations. This is a way to have stability in the region. I would agree that that's definitely an ideal outcome. The feasibility of that, unfortunately, is very low, and the probability of that is even lower, in the sense that if you look at one episode when there was discussion of a peace agreement ending the armistice, moving to some kind of negotiation, normalization relation, there was a huge uproar over three or four countries being at the table. The reactions of China to that statement shows the enormous sensitivity. And while clearly a peace agreement and the normalization of relations is a way to have more of a stable foundation, each country has a very specific and different way to approach that. And the lowest common denominator of that, unfortunately, is not satisfactory to any of the parties. And so in the immediate period, while we hope that that would be a development, I think the probability of that is quite low.
Yes, at the back.
Sorry to stand up again, but John, your green topic, I have no problem there. Got myself a charging my movement in 2009. But subtitle, however, I can argue, seems to me, because you are talking about revolutionary obsolete new one that, you know, based on your reading of all joint editorial from others in the economic sort of development scene that demonstrates pushing. And then second, the subtitle is, as you say, the regime solidification being replicated, or can it be? It seems to me that you are reading too much, it seems. I know where you come from in terms of your training and interest, but the historical theme of what happened in the past, one can say, one can learn from the lessons of history, perhaps. But in terms of your subtitle, where you are pushing your theme as you did, which is very imaginative and a creative exercise, but yet I personally think that you have to be very careful there. Time may be a hero in a way. Kim Jong-il has not died, he has a problem. Maybe Chang Dong-taek, his brother in law, and the military will have a collective leadership as reported in the newspaper as a speculation. So who knows how long Kim Jong-il is going to live, and that kind of a problem. But I have two specific questions to elicit your comments. First is, Hu Jintao's envoy made a trip to North Korea and invited Kim Jong-il to come and visit China, perhaps in the course of 2009. So what is your analysis and the evaluation of that development, of course? And the second question has to do with, Kim Jong-il, political succession from his father, Kim Il-sung, and the Kim Jong-il family, kind of a realistic succession. But Kim Jong-il, if he dies sooner or later, how is this succession a question to be handled by North Korea after Kim Jong-il's death? Perhaps the Cholima movement or whatever you speculated could be tied with the domestic rather than North Korea-China foreign relations, but domestic political implications. I'd like to elicit your comments.
Sure. Sure. The point about can regime solidification in this manner be replicated? That was a rhetorical question. My point is not to say yes. I very much agree with your point that the time periods are very different. But the invocation of Cholima shouldn't be seen as something that's abnormal. We just had a president take a train from Philadelphia to Washington to replicate Lincoln's journey. And he's invoked the many of these things where country has overcome. So this is something that's not unique to the United States. It's not unique to North Korea. But with respect to the very specific questions that you raised about things like Wang Jiabei's visit to North Korea, I think it's very significant in the sense that when you have that type of exchange, a lot of things come out of it that we see and a lot of things come out of it that we don't see. One of the most secretive relationships in the world right now is the Communist Party relationship with the Korea Workers' Party. That's something that the Chinese don't even talk about internally. So with respect to what happened and what has been laid out, whose invitation to Kim Jong-il and so forth, there are many things to that I think it's still early to tell. But that, I think, is a nod that Kim Jong-il is the man in North Korea. There was a lot of speculation and there was a lot of government discussion about North Korea being on its last legs, contingency planning, things along those lines. And clearly that's something that's alarming to North Korea, but that's also very alarming to China. And so this is in the realm of speculation, but for China to send that message very publicly It shows that they acknowledge the supremacy of Kim Jong-il, and it somehow reduces those concerns of North Korea's imminent collapse. You know, clearly we have to be prepared for sudden change inside North Korea, but the level of discussion in this past fall was the highest that it had been in many years, and something that was considered to be destabilizing. The second question about Kim Il-sung and grooming Kim Jong-il, clearly that can't be replicated. That is something that was very unique. It took over a decade, and Kim Jong-il, by the time he was in a position to come to the head of the structure, even then it took a couple of extra years. So it wasn't anything automatic. But the reason I introduced this idea of North Korea Incorporated is to conceptualize something that is still in need of much more examination analysis, but offering that as a way to even examine something like leadership transition and perhaps also some aspect of succession. I think from a capabilities analysis, the ability for any leader or group of leaders to run North Korea, they will have to be good at making money, because in a post-Kim Jong-il period, be that in a few months, a few years, and I acknowledge your point as well that he could live for quite a bit longer, the ability to make money in a post-Kim Jong-il period will be very important to have loyalty, to have regime support, and also to doyle out things. And so the North Korea Incorporated approach is a very crude approach to hopefully opening up a new way to examine some of the bottom-up and domestic issues inside North Korea.
Let me take one final question in this round. Okay, I'll take a couple in this round before turning it over to Professor Armstrong.
Yeah. My name is Jim Hurd, and I wanted to ask a question about how do you see the progress of commercialization and foreign investment gradually happening between North Korea and the outside. And the reason why I mention this is that I keep in touch with an Australian friend of mine who spends quite a bit of time in Pyongyang and has been active in forming the Cormet Group on a major iron ore mine, and also the negotiations that have happened on a major coalbed methane agreement with the Swiss group. So I think it's possibly a historic time in this area. I'd like to know what your thoughts are.
It's a question to me, as well as the panel, or? I think the topic of foreign investment and commercial activities in North Korea has been there for a while, and it's amazing for some entities, they see a lot of opportunity in North Korea, genuine opportunity. And the usual pattern is that they see the opportunity, they go there, they start up a business enterprise, they line up a North Korean partner. Suddenly, initial investment requires a building of roads. You have to take care of your own transportation. Literally, you have to do everything over a period of time. And for any private venture, it just no longer becomes feasible. The return on that quickly disappears. And so you have a list of countries in China, Japan, among the North Korean residents, the Joseon Soran, who set up businesses in North Korea, where they've gone bankrupt. And so the recent developments are interesting because Orascom, the Egyptian telecoms company, is inside North Korea right now. And they've done their market analysis, and they feel confident that they can hit a certain subscriber base. I think the report in Financial Times a little while ago was $15 in terms of monthly average revenue per user. So they've done their number analysis and whatnot, and they feel that this is not only a commercially viable enterprise, but something where even if they lose all their money, they think that later on they could probably go in and this will be an early foray into the North Korean market and perhaps into that sub-regional area. But the prospects of FDI and commercial activity in North Korea, the whole North Korea Incorporated angle is relatively new. But one of the key things that come out of that is proximity really matters. You have to be close to the Chinese border, and for your entity to do anything along the lines of recurring business, that proximity is very, very important. And so the commercial activity, the foreign investment, all of those things, there'll always be that danger, and it's the danger of costs adding up very, very quickly because it's so underdeveloped in key areas of North Korea, in many areas of North Korea. But look at the countries that are going in and observe how they perform. I think going forward we'll hear more about the Chinese example. I'll end on the one example of Chinese joint ventures in certain parts of North Korea. There have been some reports where a Chinese partner goes in, finds a North Korean partner for something like mine development. North Korean partner is not able to make the initial investment, financial investment. So they work out an agreement where, as an example, the 5 years after they start production, 80% of the output will go to the Chinese partner, 20% will go to the North Korean partner as a way to compensate for the North Korean partner not putting the initial investment in the beginning. And these are based on interviews in Qingdao with some of the Chinese companies that are doing these type of activities. But when you look at that overall model, it looks very flexible, and in some instances it's viable. But when you do something like zero in on the 80-20 split, that looks like exploitation of resources in North Korea. So, you know, clearly there'll always be business deals where it's favoring one side over the other. But that type of structure shows you that there's an element of creativity and flexibility.
Just a final question in this round.
Mike Kim, author of Escaping North Korea. John, you talked about the responsibility of various groups having to provide funds, operating funds, and raising funds for Korea. I was just curious, were you able to find any themes as far as how the different groups pursue business opportunities? Any differences there, and also any sense of financials, you know, how much money is going back and forth, whether it's, you know, you're able to get some data or more anecdotal information.
Sure. So this is how the system is supposed to work. And this is based on the defector interviews. You receive a work authorization from the party or some other very senior, high-level organization. And in that work authorization, it lays out what quota, how much of a particular quantity. So, for example, if you're going to do something like cultivate songi mushrooms, which are very, very valuable when you sell them to places like Japan, you have a certain quantity. You're able to go and extract that amount, and then you're expected to produce a certain amount in terms of foreign currency generation. Now, that is how the system is supposed to work, and then from the proceeds of that sale, everyone gets their cut. But as you see different elements of creativity, corruption, and people have the means and the networks and whatnot, there's now the forgery of the work authorization document itself. So where you have something like, you know, 100,000 pounds of X quantity, there's a forgery and the quantity's increased. But everyone takes wind of this and suddenly people take a cut. So as that amount, that quantity is produced and sent up the sort of organizational chain, everyone takes a little bit of or a lot of what's produced, and then they claim that the amount that was laid out wasn't produced. But, you know, somehow the system works itself out. When eventual quantity that's left goes and is sold and the foreign currency is generated, that's again supposed to be sent down and eventually to the laborers at the lowest level. But in many instances, the amount that goes to the very lower level is almost negligible. Then you have a lot of questions. How is the system able to maintain itself? And clearly one of the questions we asked the defectors. Defectors said that the labor pool is so vast that if a laborer is shortchanged, they can go and conscript or get other laborers. So there's a certain element of knowing what parts are flexible, what parts are rigid, reading it very well, and then maximizing volume. And so in terms of themes, though, the earlier question, it's in the work authorization. You know, you can get X quantity of songi mushrooms, or, you know, if you're one of the very elite North Korean state companies, you're allowed to deal in state commodity, which is gold. And in terms of financials, I think you're in the category of, like, Enron financials. I think they produce numbers as is deemed politically fit.
James Person would just like to comment briefly on the question I posed. This is at the outset concerning possible repercussions if the goals are not met by 2012.
Okay. Right. So what will North Korea do short of changing Kim Il-sung's birthday? I think they're going to try to mobilize the masses to get some result. Clearly what constitutes a strong and prosperous nation, or what constitutes a success, is subjective. The North Koreans are touting their, you know, the fact that there are Juche Seri groups in Madagascar as a success in ideology. Their nuclear test, which, you know, at first we weren't even sure if it was a nuclear test because it didn't register strong enough, that was a success. There's an interesting story about a North Korean success at the time of the Cholima movement. The tractor that I showed, the Cholima tractor, North Korea needed several thousand tractors and simply could not afford to purchase them from the Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries that were producing tractors at the time. So what they did is they purchased, I think, two or three tractors, brought them to North Korea, completely disassembled them, and created the and built the parts themselves from scratch. It was a quite a big event when they introduced the Torima tractor to the populace. Thousands of people gathered to see this. They had the tractor, started up, it was running, put it into gear, and it went backwards. Went in reverse for about 5 minutes and finally conked out. Kim Il-sung heralded this as a success, however, because the North Koreans by themselves had created a tractor that could move. Then they worked out the kinks and eventually produced them. But again, I think what constitutes a success or a strong and prosperous country is subjective, and they'll tout whatever results they can achieve as a success.
Thank you. Well, Professor Armstrong has been listening quite patiently, so why don't you take the floor?
Should I come up there? Or?
Well, it's up to you, but you can stay right where you are, or you can come to the podium.
Why don't I come up? That might actually be a little
easier to
see. I will keep my remarks short, and we may find ourselves in the unprecedented position of being 35 minutes ahead of schedule by the time I'm done. It's an honor to be here. I'm very grateful to the Woodrow Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace. And am I picking up? Can you hear me?
I don't know if that's on.
Now I'll turn this on. How's that?
So we could, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It's gonna restart. I should have stayed where I was.
Do you want to do that?
I think we can just unknot that and bring it over here.
I hope
it's
the tractor.
It will be a success in any case. Any case it will be successful.
We will just declare it a success.
No.
Never mind. Okay. Back to my seat.
Now, is this on? I wanted to thank the Woodrow Wilson Center and the U.S. Institute of Peace for inviting me to do the easy part of this very interesting panel, which is to comment on these well-prepared and well-researched presentations. Let me begin with picking up on the last question: what if nothing happens in 2012? Well, the regime can say that something did happen and declare a victory. And people have a remarkable ability to forget the future. I remember in the 1970s there was a very prominent televangelist who predicted with great certainty that Jesus Christ would come back to earth at the latest by 1988 and the world as we know it would end. As far as I know, that did not happen, and yet this televangelist still has his own program. So these sorts of predictions, I don't think we should worry about too much, particularly in the case of North Korea. In a society where people are exhorted constantly to live for the future lasts forever, and there's no reason that we should have a definitive end to the goals in sight. So long as there's basic quality of subsistence in life, I think the system can continue. And to carry on to that point, I want to begin with my own impressionistic view of a visit to North Korea and then talk about the three papers. I first visited North Korea in the fall of 1997 thanks to the invitation of Dr. Stephen Linton and the Eugene Bell Foundation. Dr. Linton is here today. I felt very privileged to be there even though it was an extremely difficult time for North Korea. In retrospect, we can see that it was the peak of the food crisis of the late 1990s. After 3 years of disastrous floods and drought, and before the stabilization of the food situation in 1998. My rather surrealistic impression of North Korea at that time was not that it existed as a backward country, but that it existed somehow in another time dimension altogether. A modern society but with a different kind of modernity, somewhat of a parallel universe. Now, of course, North Korea does exist in this world, in this dimension, but the type of economy, the type of society, the type of political system that it has put into place since the 1940s has taken on a very different condition of progress and of the development of time than the societies that we are familiar with. There's also a different attitude about collective action as well, as was discussed earlier, which is, I think, not necessarily unique to Korea. Perhaps we should keep in mind that our own individualistic society in this country is quite distinctive compared to many others. I find it, to get back to another theological point, I also find it interesting that these Cholama announcements always take place right around Christmas time. Kim Jong-il visited the birthplace of Cholama on December 24th last year. Kim Il-sung announced Cholama on December 26, 1956. And given Kim Il-sung's Presbyterian Sunday school background, I find it hard to believe it's a coincidence. The first statue of Kim Il-sung, by the way, was erected on Christmas Day, 1946. I've often thought that it would be better to analyze North Korea from the perspective of theology than of political science, or at least that not that North Korea is a theocracy exactly, but that it cannot be seen as a kind of normal political system as most conventional political science would describe it. History, I think, matters. I'm a professional historian, so of course I have to believe that, but I think it matters in general and in North Korea in particular. North Korea, after all, has had the same leadership, the same family in power, the same political system, basically the same economic system for some 60 years, which doesn't suggest stasis. Doesn't mean that nothing has changed, but there has been a deep continuity. Even compared, perhaps especially compared to China, with which North Korea has borne many similarities, which vacillated from one extreme to another in the course of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, North Korea has been remarkably stable, and perhaps to its detriment. One could argue that if North Korea had experienced something as obviously disastrous as the Great Leap Forward, it might have changed direction and moved more radically into a liberalization program as China did in the 1970s, but this did not happen. Cholima can be seen as a failure, but it is never portrayed as such. And as James Pearson has said earlier, Cholima officially has never ended. So it's not so much that Cholima has been restarted, but that the idea of Cholima has been revived. I think these roots go back farther than the 1950s, however. This phrase, self-reliance, Juche is one expression, but another common phrase is Jaryo Gengseng, regeneration through one's own efforts, which is the identical phrase to the Chinese expression of the 1950s and 60s, Zili Gongsheng. Actually, both have their roots in the Japanese home ministry slogan, Jiriki Kyose, or self-reliance, which was evoked in the early 1930s to promote domestic self-reliance in the run-up to war in that country. North Korea has always been a state which has acted as a product of this crisis of the mid-20th century from the 1930s, 1940s, and has had a great deal of difficulty moving beyond this kind of wartime mobilization crisis regime. North Korea has, Cholima is a perfect example of this, the perfect representation of this. This emphasis on speed and modernity and this kind of quaint, almost, technological sense of the Stalin period or of the mid-20th century. In my own work on post-war reconstruction in North Korea, I was struck by this the use of this phrase, Pyongyang Sokdo, Pyongyang speed, in which allegedly an apartment could be built in 14 minutes. There was never any comment on how good the apartments were, but they could be made very quickly. So this type of industrialization, this type of mobilization of the collective for rapid, above all, growth, which, by the way, we've seen in South Korea as well, and sometimes with equally disastrous results, has been a mainstay of North Korea. But North Korea has never really been self-reliant. What happened, however, is with the collapse of its trading partners in the Eastern Bloc in the late 80s and early 90s, this self portrayal of self-reliance had to be made into a reality. In a certain kind of grim way, perhaps, some of North Korea's leaders must feel exonerated because unlike Russia, which capitulated to the capitalists, all they had to do was stick around until now and see capitalism collapse in the West. Juche, in other words, became a necessity of North Korea in the 1990s. But like in the post-war period, after the Korean War, North Korea appears to be re-emerging from a near-fatal catastrophe. And this is one way in which the current period can be seen as somewhat analogous to the late 1950s when Chol Im-ma was first announced, which James Person outlines very well. North Korea is asserting its independence, its collective will, emphasizing internal coherence and unity for a movement of economic reconstruction. And I think this comes on the heels of what was a worrisome trend to at least some of the leadership toward openness and liberalization. There's been some very good analysis of how North Korea has backtracked on some of its economic reforms in the last 3 or 4 years. And this kind of revival of the spirit of Chol Im-ma, as it were, seems to be a way to try to maintain or create a kind of momentum of taking North Korea to the next stage of economic development without relinquishing the authority of the state and without jettisoning all the ideology that North Korea has been based on for the last 60 years. Now, whether this can succeed today is, of course, very much an open question. I'll get in a moment to John's comments on North Korea, Inc., which I think are very, very interesting. Of course, they didn't really succeed in the 1960s either. But whether you can really graft 21st century technology, as North Korea seems to want to do, to modernize the country onto this very mid-20th century sort of social mobilization and state-directed development may be as improbable and as fanciful as this hybrid monster, the winged horse of Chol Im-ma. We'll see whether that can actually be done. It seems to me that we shouldn't, and I agree with the point made earlier, that we shouldn't read too much in the revival of the slogan in terms of the specifics. I don't think North Korea is going back to Chol Im-ma by any means, certainly not in terms of the actual content of its economic program. But rather, the emergence of this term, of these slogans at this time, seems to me to suggest that this is a message the state is sending to the North Korean people to be prepared for something big. Big changes are afoot. A major experiment is going to happen, and the people have to be united in a collective will in order to meet these challenges. Now, exactly what they will do, we can speculate on that, and I'll get back to that in a moment. On Bernd Schaefer's paper, which I think really addresses the question, if James Person talked about the origins and the reasons for the emergence of Chol Im-ma, when and why did North Korea fail in its economy? Now, people sometimes talk about North Korea as a failed state, which I wouldn't use at all as a term to describe North Korea. It is not a failed state. In fact, actually, in some ways, North Korea is a victim of its own success. If there's one thing that North Korea has succeeded in doing, it's keeping its state together. But its economy has been nothing short of a disaster. It wasn't necessarily doomed from the beginning, nor did it collapse in the 1990s, but a reading of North Korean history, it seems to me, suggests that it really started to grind down in the mid-1960s with the petering out of the Chol Im-ma movement, the so-called equal emphasis policy on military and civilian economic allocation. And even at that point, North Korea was still ahead of the South. We mustn't forget that South Korea has not always been the affluent society it was either, and didn't surpass the South until the 1970s, possibly even in the 1980s in terms of per capita standard of living. I won't question or go into detail all the specific problems that Bernd points out, with which I agree, and the kind of often heavy-handed way that North Korea has tried to address these problems, each solution of which seems to lead North Korea down the slippery slope to economic disaster. But as far as whether North Korea can live up to its promises, it should not be forgotten that North Korea has never met its economic planning goals since 1960. So that failure to meet these specific goals is nothing unfamiliar. But rather, what North Korea has succeeded very brilliantly in a way of doing is maintaining a political cohesion and social mobilization, if not loyalty, at least a certain kind of compliance to the regime. In that sense, I think North Korea has been one of the most successful regimes, for better or for worse, in the world. Again, whether that can translate this kind of politics of the 1950s into an economic program of the 2000s, we'll have to see. I just had a couple of comments on John Park's presentation. I think this notion of North Korea incorporated is a very valuable one. I think that the use of various state and military institutions for business purposes is really going on. But I, as a historian, I have to ask, when did this begin? And I don't think this is an entirely new development. I think it at least has its roots visible to the outside world in the 1970s when it appears that North Korean missions abroad were instructed to make money by whatever means necessary. And then you had incidences such as North Korean diplomats getting caught smuggling alcohol and cigarettes out of Sweden and so forth. So there is actually a rather long history of, as it were, the kind of privatization or the sort of self-reliance of the local political arms in North Korea. But clearly, North Korea has gone much farther down this path in recent years out of necessity because of the collapse of the centralized planning system, but also, I think, because of certain positive examples that they've seen, particularly with China. And on the question of China, although clearly China is the most important partner for North Korea, I myself have always been a bit of a China skeptic in general. I don't think the 21st century will be China's century, but that's somewhat beside the point. I do think, however, we have to be somewhat careful in looking at the relationship between China and North Korea. We should not overemphasize the degree of influence and leverage that China has over North Korea, but also, equally if not more importantly, we shouldn't underemphasize the degree to which North Korea fears and wants to do whatever is possible to avoid dependence on China. And this is nothing new either. If we really look at the history of Korea and China's relations, and I mean the long history going back several centuries, all this talk about Sade and serving the great and subservience to China, the Koreans never believed that. The Chinese might have believed that because it served their interests. But in fact, if you really look carefully at the correspondence between the Joseon and Chinese and Qing governments, you'll see that the Chinese were very frustrated with the Koreans. The Koreans never gave them the gratitude they expected, and never did what they were told, and always acted as if they ran their own country. And in that sense, I think North Korea represents much more of a continuity from in Korean traditions, including Korean-Chinese relations, than even South Korea. What I think North Korea is trying to do, rather, and this new slogan seems to be pointing possibly in that direction, is to diversify its external partners. And I would read this partly as an articulation of a hope for new and expanded trade and economic partnerships, particularly with the United States and with Japan and with other Western countries. And my final point about the future of North Korea, we're at an interesting point in North Korea watching. The last 15 years have been dominated by two perspectives, I would say, on North Korea's future. One, the kind of hardline perspective that emphasized coercion, is that North Korea is an incorrigible regime that cannot be changed, And what we should do is to put as much pressure on them as possible, and the regime will collapse. The other liberal pro-engagement perspective has seemed to be more benign, but underneath that policy of benign engagement was, I think, a common belief that opening up North Korea would, in due course, perhaps very rapidly, also lead to the collapse of North Korea, such as happened in Eastern Europe. But in fact, what we may be seeing is a kind of survival strategy that might actually work. One shouldn't underestimate the adaptability of North Korea and its remarkable penchant for survival under extraordinary difficult circumstances. And this sort of hybrid winged horse, chimera-like, or whatever you might call it, system might represent something that will enable North Korea to survive moving forward. We shouldn't assume that either liberal democracy and capitalism is the way of the future for everyone, or that North Korea will remain unchanged permanently, but rather North Korea, through this and other initiatives, may be representing a different kind of course, a rather unique course that may not be very attractive to many people, may not be in the best interest of the North Korean people, but may be a means by which the system can continue in modified form for an indefinite period of time. Thanks. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, for that, for your comments on the three presentations. And now let me open it up to our formal question and answer period.
Can I use the mic?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, happy to use it. Not karaoke. I'm Junho Kim, a new graduate from the University of Hawaii. Listening to three presenters, I got a feeling that the title of this event will be an economic development issues and North Korea-China relations. But I don't get a sense that the Cholima movement implies any relevance to the current situation. Well, as Dr. Williams asked a question before Dr. Park presented, the real motivation of the Cholima movement was a political thing, not economic thing. Kim Il-sung's intention that time was to mobilize resources to increase the military capability. In the atmosphere, the Koreans wanted to reunify the nation again by force. There was a fever for the reunification in the post-war Koreas, North and South. So the people were willing to support their leadership by doing their efforts to increase the economic capability in order to support the military. What about now? Well, if the same frame is applied to the current situation, the North Korean leadership might persuade the people to support the leadership in the strengthening the nuclear power by increasing the economic capability. That's one comment. My question is about a professor mentioned that domestic figures who might be able to influence the decision making, for example, Chang Sung-taek or other military or party figures. We don't know from the outside who do the main politics around the Kim Jong-il, but we may have to be cautious when we read North Korean politics. So we need to have information or analysis of the domestic politics changes as well as foreign relations. So China is a big big factor influencing over North Korean behavioral changes. However, if I suggest that I get the kind of pattern that in the 1960s, North Korea tried to escape from the Soviet influence toward China in order to gain more support. Nowadays, North Korea probably try to escape from China toward the U.S. to gain more. So if we compare those two patterns, we may find more implications. Thank you.
Thank you.
I can start. Tolima was not actually about the military mobilization. It was actually mobilizing the masses to increase production, to improve the economy. It was only in the 60s, the early 60s, that, like after the Cuban Missile Crisis, that the December plenum, that North Korea really began to focus more on military and diverted more and more resources to building up the military. Before this, it was more on building up industry. And Kim Il-sung actually had some practical reasons for doing this. You're absolutely right. Reunification was on his mind. Kim Il-sung thought that a strong, industrialized North Korea, and you can see this in the documents, in internal North Korean documents that we've obtained, Kim Il-sung thought that a strong, industrialized North Korea would actually draw South Korean people to support the Korean Workers' Party. It was not to relaunch an attack on South Korea to unify the peninsula or anything like that. But he also thought that it would guarantee more independence for North Korea from outside influence such as the Soviet Union. He didn't want another Sade type relationship with the Soviets or even with the Chinese, and for that reason resisted pressure to join the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance, resisted pressure to follow development strategies of other countries. But it was not, Cholima was not military. It wasn't until the mid-60s that North Korea really began to focus on military.
I was talking about the political interpretation of it, that movement. Yes, sir. It was used for political military purpose later.
Initially, I mean, the period that we're talking about, though, and the primary goal of Cholima was to mobilize the masses to achieve goals, and at the time it was this is the what they're I think talking about today. But John, did you want to touch on the question of leadership? And
I'm actually not also.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. There's another question. I don't think, John, should it be? I guess maybe I should.
Steve Litton, Eugene Bell Foundation. I just want to ask a series of questions, not just to get answers, but also perhaps to broaden the discussion. In a sense, in Washington, you kind of have to go with what you can get, and the New Year message is some of the very little information or insight we have. But is it really a blueprint for the future, or is it a reaffirmation of core values primarily? And I think we want it to be, in a sense, of the future, but I'm not sure it always is. The other is, couldn't you find the roots for the Cholima movement not just in the 50s, but actually you find in North Korean hagiography a lot of references to Kim Il-sung using speed chuk-chuk-bup to move around as a guerrilla. I'm not sure it said he actually wrote a Cholima. There may have been a reference to that, but in a sense, isn't this simply a recasting of the guerrilla movement theme that is so prevalent in North Korea and that you find all the way through as well as latching on to a myth, and in that sense linking the leadership to mythology, as some people have. Also, the Chelimo movement, as I understand it, and Charles could certainly tell me more, that wasn't that the golden age, in a sense, or the golden decade of North Korea? In other words, it's that decade also would provoke many fond memories from a lot of people who remember that area. Finally, this focus on clothing and food and
housing,
isn't that more a repetition of a very, very common and ancient theme that basically government should be involved with Ushikju? I mean, it goes way back in Korean. In other words, is this a plan, or is this an affirmation of the sincerity of government to be concerned about the core needs of its population? In other words, could we broaden this out perhaps a little bit to take in some more traditional orientations?
Well, thank you. You've asked a number of questions there, but they all seem sort of tied with history, so perhaps I could ask Charles to take a crack, since we're talking about the roots of Cholima, whether and the repetition of ancient themes and core values.
Well, it's a little odd for me to respond to Steve, since he, in a sense, was one of my initial teachers about North Korea. But I myself, as I think I tried to point out in my comments, I don't see a lot that's new in this, but rather, on the contrary, a reassertion of the role of the state after a number of years of what, as I mentioned, must have seemed rather worrisome trends of liberalization and free market movement in North Korea. But also, yes, that the state should have this role of taking care of its people. That's a very old tradition. Reaffirmation of core values of the DPRK itself, but also of a kind of paternalistic state which has failed its people to a great extent for the last decade or so. Now, of course, food, clothing, and housing should be essentials that everyone should have, but the key point here is that if those very basic needs, even those, are not being met, there's a real problem. And that, as Berndt is pointing out, for decades, Kim Il-sung and his successors have been saying, we have yet to resolve these the problems of basic necessities. The roots of Cholima, or the myth of Cholima, yes, of course, it goes back to the guerrilla movement days and the image of Kim Il-sung, as so much of the moral exhortation and collective campaigning of North Korea has done, from the very beginning of the regime, but in the last post-Cold War years, the arduous march was the slogan of getting through the late 1990s and the food shortage there, and now it seems we're moving beyond that. And this gets to me to my final point. The Cholima period was or at least can seem now in retrospect a kind of golden age. The post-war reconstruction was over. North Koreans were getting better off all the time. North Korea had probably the highest rates of industrial growth in the world in the late 1950s. And these are glory days to evoke. If there is one time in the history of North Korea where people can feel positive about the past, that would be it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good. My name is Tom Kim from SAIS. I want just to make, I will share some of my own experience with dealing with the North Koreans. On Cholima movement, for example, we used to call in English flying falls. This in the 50s and 60s. I spent about a half a century in working on North Korean issue in my life. And then
But by the time we came to 90s, then they were, North Koreans much like horses, then they said a gallon horse, Juma, instead of, so let's ride gallon horse. That was the 90s. And then like you mentioned, Chada Kyung-sang, later they moved on to, because Juche came up around the same time, of course, and they dropped the frequent use of Juche nowadays. It seems to be replaced by Songun, or military first policy. So there is a certain pattern of evolution of North Korean rhetoric terms. That's one thing. But in essence, I think it is all referring to the basic, the value of a North Korean regime and attitude toward how they're going to run their country. I think along a similar line, Dr. Linton alluded to. I think that's right there. Other than that, I want to just share some of the experiences. If you, I mean, latest, recently, Im Dong-won, who was a former Minister of Unification and also National Intelligence Services Director and whatnot, he put out a book called Peacemaker. It's not available in English yet. I had an email correspondence with him, and I said that should be translated into English so that it would have some consumption among Korea watchers here in the United States as well. I think that is the single volume that contains most of what Kim Jong-il has said in his dialogue with Kim Dae-jung and also with Im Dong-won. And having my own, based on 12 hours Albright spent with Kim Jong-il, if you put all these, the words that were actually uttered by Kim Jong-il, you would have some sense of what the leader of North Korea is trying to move his country country to. And you talk about this DPRK or Sino-DPRK relationship, and as early or late as 2000, October 2000, I came away from that meeting with a clear sense that North Korea really wants to move away from either Russia and China and toward the United States, under the provided that United States, with the signed peace treaty, and also would go through the process of normalization, become exchange of embassies in both Pyongyang and Washington, and then change the status of U.S. forces in Korea, not as but as a forces and whose role would be balancer of stability in Asia, thus Kim Jong-un making very clear that he's not opposed to the idea of a continued U.S. military presence in South Korea. And I got that very strongly, and I can document all that. And at one point he said, he told Albright, and you can say anything that I have said, don't add anything, but don't subtract anything, but other than this part. That is, I have not talked to Russians or Chinese on the road of the U.S. Of course, it goes back to earlier Kim Jong-un's encounter at the meeting in 91 during latter years of Bush 41. So he all supported that. But I think last 8 years of the U.S. administration pushed DPRK toward China. That's clear reading. I got out of knowing where Kim Jong-il stood at that point. I don't know. This is 8 years have passed. But I think what I still can say is they often say, well, we lived 5,000 years without help from the United States. Just leave us alone. We never bothered. We never even thrown any stone at you. You're the ones, you know, who attacked us. You always threatened us and whatnot. But they're ready to go on its own path, isolation. It is a welcome thing to do for the internal stability. That's the better. And I think this is where South Korea's, the North Korean policy of de-nuclearization opening to 3000 has a problem with it, because it is understood by the North Koreans as South Korea would help North Korea only
only after denuclearization and opening. But it is not the original idea of the architect who had all kinds of controversy nowadays to get confirmed as Minister of Unification. So I was going to ask either John Prock or anyone else, what impact, what would you be your assessment of the impact of the deteriorated inter-Korean relations that would have on the process of denuclearization, and what U.S. can do about it? I mean, I have my own views, but I'd like to hear your voice.
Yes, thank you. John, do you want to take that?
Well, if we look at it clearly from the period of the Nomuyon and Kim Dae-jung governments, North Korea received tremendous assistance from South Korea. And that introduced an element of timing. Timing is a very funny thing in dealing with North Korea, because at that time, the progressive governments in South Korea in dealing with North Korea were engaging North Korea at a time where it was a very difficult situation with Washington and Pyongyang. And so with the current deteriorating inter-Korean relationship, the impact, I think one pattern of North Korean behavior is the ability to have one country providing assistance, but always a plan B of sorts. I think there was this element of getting assistance from China and South Korea, and there was a dynamic of playing Seoul off of Beijing. But right now, there is a disproportionate reliance on China, and it's not to say that that's North Korea's preference. But isolation is something that they would like to manage, but when it's something that they have to react to, it seems like a very different situation altogether. And in terms of its impact on how the U.S. perhaps will deal with North Korea, I think it's now a point where we're long past anything related to bilateral U.S.-North Korea relations. The U.S. in engaging North Korea, it automatically proliferates into U.S. policy implications with Japan, with China, with South Korea. And so the situation is getting very complicated, and bilateral is something that in key instances may breathe life into something like the six-party talks, as we saw with the U.S. re-engagement of North Korea following the nuclear test. But when it comes to signing documents, it's one thing. When it comes to implementation, the coordination required, moving everyone together along implementation, I think we have to manage our expectations. And it goes back to that point of, are we going to resolve the North Korean problem, or are we going to try to manage it? Those who examine the issues very carefully, one of the clear recognitions is that managing it in and of itself is a Herculean task. And so trying to resolve it is something that I think is completely different altogether.
Well, you want to ask? I was going to wrap up because I could. I was looking at, even though we had budgeted for more time, I could see participants leaving, so I didn't want to have everybody leave. But let me ask you to ask the final question, and then we'll wrap up because we've had a very rich discussion.
All right, thank you. This is my name is Randall Spadoni. I'm from World Vision. A question for John Park, quick one. You know, talking about this idea of North Korea incorporated and the requirement for North Korean government organizations to raise their own resources, do you get the sense that this is increasing competition between government organizations at all? And if so, how does that affect the ability of the North Korean government to implement unified economic policy?
A couple of caveats. First is that the research on this North Korea incorporated project is very early stage. Second caveat is that it's heavily dependent on defector interviews. And so you can view that one way in the sense of how do you verify all the information that you're getting? And then the other part is that if they are piecing something together, realistically, they only know 360 immediately around them. And so it's an exercise in trying to get all the pieces and trying to put together an overall picture. And that's going to be an arduous task. Having said all of that, I'll take a crack at your question. And if I view it from that angle of competition among the different branches, at this stage, there's enough room and enough opportunities where cooperation through corruption and other activities. That is something that's coming out more. And again, it may be a function of we've only scratched the surface in terms of the defector interviews. But in the instances where we've seen an opportunity, a situation that can go either a route of competition or cooperation, it's this idea of let's increase the pie because there's pretty much no pie in a lot of parts of North Korea. And there's also this certain notion that the bigger your racket is, the more protection you have and the more sustainable it is. And that, I think, invites this idea of getting more and more partners, be it border guards that you can have more access points, be it other, you know, transportation type of facilitators and getting goods moved around. So you have to think it from the angle of networks building out. If there were many networks already established, I think your point of competition would be more likely. But at this early stage, it looks like there's more of this de facto cooperation.
Okay. Well, we've we have three excellent panelists today. It's been a very rich discussion. And I think one of the many themes, the important themes, and I think a clear theme which has come up this afternoon is, as Charles Armstrong put it when he was discussing the presentation, is that history matters. And not surprising for a historian, but no less important. And that history is important for us to understand the present. And I think that fact was certainly borne out in James Pearson's observation that the Cholima movement's emphasis on collective effort, harmonious participation for the good of society, helps explain why North Korea hasn't collapsed. And I think Bernd Schaefer's reminding us and recalling Kim Il-sung's remark to Honecker in 1986 that North Korea had an important need to address the three basic problems of food, housing, and clothing, again underline the importance of history in understanding those present challenges which remain. But one of the great things about history and historians is that they ask new questions about old problems, and also remind us that we have to find new tools to deal with old challenges. And John Park rightly highlighted that the North Korea regime has a new tool, in this case North Korea Inc., to deal with old and enduring challenges which confront the country. So please help me in thanking the panelists, and I also want to thank you for your active participation.